Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We're glad you're with us on the program today. Our guest today speaking to us by phone from his office is Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton, and we'd love to have your questions for him. A good way to get those in is to email them to ask, that's A-S-K, at WBAA.org, or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Mr. Mayor, it's a bit of a historic show for us here. I don't know if you're aware of this. You are the first mayor to appear on an Ask the Mayor on our new FM channel, 105.9 FM. And so it's kind of a historic day here on Ask the Mayor for us, and we're excited to have you.
Well, that's exciting. Maybe we're reaching more people. It's good to hear.
Yes, I hope so. And hopefully our listeners in Crawfordsville are picking us up on the new FM frequency. And if you are, feel free, of course, to send us an email or a tweet letting us know about that. I wanted to start by going back to something we chatted a little bit about last month on the program. That was your discussions with Walmart about how to build a road near one of its facilities there. And you'd been going back and forth with the company. I wanted to get an update on that from you and see what the latest was to start off.
Well, we're continuing those discussions, and I think we had some really good discussions just within the last few days. And I just left this morning, a meeting this morning in which we were engaging county officials to talk about our approach based on Walmart's latest discussion with us. So, you know, I think we're getting close to a resolution to that, and really the tricky part has been navigating the waters of Walmart, if you will. Those are pretty complicated, a lot of different layers there, and it's getting to the right people who can kind of understand our perspective here and move things forward. So we hope to have some announcements there, you know, maybe in the next month or so. We were kind of under the gun as far as the weather and trying to make some things happen, and that's obviously we didn't make those marks. So now we have a little bit of breathing room because we have worked on this until next construction season. But we are making progress, and I think we'll have some announcements before long.
One of the things that people will remember had happened was that you had been dealing with one person within the corporation, and then that person was no longer your point of contact all of a sudden, and you had to go back and find somebody else who you could communicate with, who would be an advocate for this project getting done. Have you found that person, that new person, whom you can talk with on an ongoing basis?
Well, we've been through several people now, even since last month. So I think we have the good connections, you know, and one of the things that had happened is one of our local newspapers kind of, you know, did a story and kind of talked about this and put it out there. And that certainly put some pressure on the local store. I know they were hearing from local residents and from their customers, which in turn activated Walmart's structure within the state of Indiana and here locally. And they were able to really kind of start to help us navigate those waters some by having them on board with us. And keeping in mind, they were on board with us early on, but, you know, years have elapsed in this process and personnel come and go. But, you know, that story kind of really pulled the local store and the state Walmart officials into this process with us.
It's nice when we in the media can light a fire under somebody every now and again.
Yeah, that's very helpful.
Let's move on to some other things you may have heard in a newscast or two that we've run earlier today. Our reporter Sarah Fenton went to a meeting earlier this week at North Montgomery High School where they're talking about changing the policy about addressing suicide there after they've had a number of students unfortunately take their own lives in the last year or so. And it seems to me, and I wanted to get your feeling on this, that it's an issue that the community is sort of coming together to address in a direct way and try to combat. Do you get that feeling?
Oh, absolutely. You know, this is something that we have to not only look at from the perspective of schools, but we as an entire community have to really discuss this issue and really start to rethink how we approach this. And obviously, it's a horrid tragedy when we talk about young people, but it goes, you know, into older people in our community as well. So I applaud what they're doing there in Montgomery Schools, and I know all three school of our corporations are communicating and talking about how to best approach these matters. And I think the most eye-opening thing for me is that they're willing to sit down and decide that, you know, we need to change how we do things. And we're not going to just say we've always done it this way and that's that. We're going to tackle these issues head-on and really rethink how we approach these things.
Of course, you have been a parent of kids who have been going through one of the local school systems. What do you hear from your kids about how this topic has been addressed to them and by people that they are in contact with?
Well, you know, my younger kids, we hear it discussed. And you didn't hear that years ago. This was something that just wasn't talked about or discussed. And they're very open about discussing this. They're very open about, you know, how what some people are doing can affect other people, you know, the bullying concepts and some of those. And so it just seems to be something that they're more free to talk about and discuss and really address, you know, where that really didn't happen years ago.
And what, if anything, can the city do to try to support these efforts that the school corporations are making?
Well, we're certainly trying to be alongside them all we can. And yesterday I attended a county crisis team meeting, which pulls all of our school corporations together, and these issues were being discussed there. So we just try to be supportive in the school environment. But stepping back from that, you know, thinking about the big picture within the community, you know, as we have discussions about the future of our community and some of our more challenging issues, this is something that fits into that discussion at some point. And I think we as a community have to come to terms with it on an overall basis. And so we're trying to at least have that discussion right now.
You mentioned this possibly transitioning from being an issue that students are talking about to being an issue that the entire community would have to grapple with. What sorts of resources are available to people in Crawfordsville and Montgomery County if folks feel like they are perhaps at risk of endangering their own lives?
Well, we think that system has been a little fractured in the past, but I see it starting to come together. We've had a group surface, you know, within the last year, a suicide prevention group, and I know they make a lot of resources available to people. Obviously, reaching into the medical community, law enforcement, you know, has to deal with this at times. You know, really is trying to pull all those resources together because right now it's kind of fractured, and so there's different paths you can go down depending on where you enter that system. You know, in Indiana, mental health is something that we've kind of put on the side burner for a while, that we are at least talking about more and making those services more available to people. So I think we have a ways to go there for sure. But at least I see all of those groups and all those pathways starting to talk to one another and communicate, and so that you're aware of the resources available in the community. But, you know, anybody here can reach into, you know, a number of places to get help if they're having issues. The mental health community, the traditional medical community, law enforcement. There's a number of gateways to enter this system, if you will.
This is kind of a side note, but when you were a firefighter and you were a paramedic, what kind of training did you receive as a first responder to try to help with a situation where somebody might be considering suicide?
You know, in the early years, when I first entered that profession in the mid-1980s, I don't think we received any. I don't recall any anyway. As time went on, I saw that change, and I see today our responders getting specific training on this issue. But, you know, back in those days, we were focused solely on the physical side of things, you know, and what had happened there. And there wasn't a lot of time spent on these behavioral issues and you know, depression and suicidal tendencies and things like that. So we didn't receive a lot back then. I'll tell you, we didn't. But I think our responders today are receiving more training. I know they're engaged with our mental health professionals, and they're thinking about things in different ways. So that's very helpful.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. Email us a question. The email address is ask@WBAA.org. And you can tweet questions during today's show to @WBAA News on Twitter. Speaking of Twitter, you retweeted a message from the Indiana Department of Transportation earlier this week talking about the ridership gains and revenue gains that the Hoosier State has made in the last year. And it sounds like, from what I've talked to NDOT officials about, that they plan to continue using some sort of contribution from local governments like yours in the funding formula that they're going to propose to be in the new two-year state budget, which will start getting discussed in January. Can you get your city council to continue going along with that?
Well, I don't think we have enough data, at least in front of us at this point, to really make a decision there. You know, when we really look at the numbers and really break those down, then I think we can go back and have a serious discussion with them about what our contribution should or shouldn't be. You know, for me, it's still a little early. I like the numbers. I like what we're seeing, and I think we are definitely headed in the right direction. I'm not sure we're to the point that we can wean off the local support totally, but I think it probably should start shifting and changing as we see these very positive, good numbers. When you see revenue up 64% from a year ago, that's significant. So we're headed in the right direction, and we'll have that discussion when the time comes.
Do you think there's going to come a point where your city council or maybe those in the other cities along the route will say the train has to be self-sufficient, it has to sustain itself financially, and we're turning off the city's or county's spigot of money?
Well, I don't know. I think some communities will get to that point. I'm not sure really that we will get totally to that point. I think there's a realization that we probably can invest some in public transportation because it is a benefit to the people of this community. I think the discussion here is at what level should we contribute or assist with that? And that really is driven by, you know, is it profitable? What do the numbers look like? You know, who else is contributing and those kind of things. So I don't think I see our council with any kind of will to say, you know, we don't just want to pull away from this, but I think they will want to see those numbers and you know, what we should be contributing versus what we shouldn't. And part of the discussion here is always, you know, centered on the fact that a lot of the riders coming out of the Crawfordsville station are not local residents. So that, again, you know, forces the discussion how much the state's contributing versus the local government. When a lot of our ridership is just simply coming here from elsewhere, and we like that. That's a great thing, but it's part of the discussion that we have to have.
You have on this program in the past described your city council as being fairly fiscally conservative. Do you think this is an easier sell to them if you can show that you are backing off the city's contribution slowly year by year?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when we first tackled this issue a few years ago, we were backed into a corner and it was a do or die. You know, if we didn't step up and make some things happen, this line was going to go away, and experience tells us once it goes away, it never comes back. So, you know, we were in a desperate situation. We stepped up to the plate, not only us, but the other communities, especially, you know, Lafayette, West Lafayette, and Tippecanoe County stepped up in a big way because we knew we were really up against a tough situation. But as this has been resolved, as we predicted it would be, I think it's comforting to all of them to know that we can start to kind of back away, because that's been the plan all along.
On to a different topic. You wrote an editorial that was published in a couple of the local newspapers there recently explaining your decision to want to write some new rules regarding rental properties and the responsibilities of landlords in your community there. First of all, if you would, give us an overview of what you think the issue is and what you're trying to solve.
Well, in that piece, I outlined some of the statistics that are involved, and I don't have those in front of me, but you know, you're looking at about 46% of the property in Crawfordsville is rental property. It's not owner-occupied. Those are significant numbers. And then I look at our code enforcement issues, of which about 3 out of 4 issues, maybe a little less, are involving rental properties. And it really starts to get expensive. But, you know, for me, at the end of the day, it's about the feedback I get from the public. And for over 4 years now, I've been hearing the public really kind of crying for something to be done with these rental properties. We have what amounts to me as a hodgepodge of regulations that are out there, so we can approach it from different angles, but there's no real way to pull all of those regulations together into one source. And what we're after here is a rental ordinance that pulls all those things together, requires these rental property owners to register their property, and then if it stands as it's written, would require them to be inspected once every 5 years. You know, we think that's a good start. We've looked around at other communities that have started to tackle these issues, and you know, I get hit a lot with, why can't we be like X community or Y community? And it does pique your curiosity, and you look around to see what they're doing, and the rental ordinance seems to be the mechanism that's kind of pushed them over the top. So this is something we've really worked on for a few years. This wasn't thrown out lightly, and work through a process to find something that I don't think is overreaching, I don't think is overly intrusive, but really allows the people in those neighborhoods to have some comfort that what's going on around them is reasonably safe, and allows people to be put in reasonably safe rental housing. And I don't think that's always the case right now.
Do you think this is a situation that you hear about a lot in college towns where you've got a lot of rentals, in some cases rentals that go primarily to students like you have in a West Lafayette or a Bloomington? You're not quite in that same situation.
No,
But is this a situation where you've got a few bad actors who own some of these properties and aren't keeping them up?
this really has very little to do with the student situation, because most of the students in our case live on campus. This has more to do with landlords who own several properties. And, you know, do we have a few bad apples? Yes, I would say probably more than a few. And many times those are out-of-town owners who buy property here. And, you know, some of them have just flat told me, I'm going to buy in Crawfordsville because there's less regulation and I can spend a little bit of money and have this income and not have to worry about it. So, you know, we at some point, it's a discussion that our community has to have, and that's been my point with putting this on the agenda with the council. It's something we thought long and hard about. We've tried to propose what we think is a realistic solution, and it's time our community starts to have some of these tough discussions. And this is a discussion that certainly generates some conversation.
Do you have certain neighborhoods where there's a higher density of rental units and thus you wind up with a higher concentration of police calls and fire calls
there? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the data is pretty clear. We know, you know, where that's happening. But, you know, another issue that's out there that we tied to this, and it's not a direct issue, but it is a, you know, it is a spinoff, is the abuse of the homestead exemption. And that is something that's run rampant in our community for some time, and obviously that's a county function to ensure that people have one homestead exemption and that that's applied properly. But in our case, it's just not being applied properly, and I can virtually walk down any street and pull up apartment building after apartment building with homestead exemptions. So we're tying that to this as well.
Well, and of course, that affects your property tax revenue, which affects the amount of money that the city and the county have to spend. Because as people may or may not know, if they've never owned a house, I mean, you're allowed to claim a homestead exemption for a building in which you personally live. And it lists, it asks you, do you live in the property or do you just own the property and rent it out to somebody else? And theoretically, that second scenario is not supposed to be one that you're allowed to claim the homestead exemption on. But you're telling me that's what happens there.
That's exactly what happens. And when I say it happens, I don't mean it happens just a few times. I can just virtually walk down any street and pull up, you know, house after house in which this is happening. And I can pull up people. I can pull up individuals' names on the database, on the county system, and find people, individual people with multiple homestead exemptions. You know, sometimes three, four. 2 years ago, I found a guy with 7 homestead exemptions. Now, I think that's been reduced, and I think that person now only has like 3, but it's still, he has 3. You know, so that has an impact. And my point is that it's not creating a level playing field for those who are playing by the rules. You know, if you're renting property and you're a landlord and you are paying your taxes properly and you're competing with the guy down the street who's in some many cases not paying any taxes at all, I can show you property after property where there's zero due because the AAV is so low, and then you put these exemptions on top. You know, so they're not paying any taxes. That is not a level playing field.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but isn't that tax fraud?
It would seem to me it is, yeah. So I can't carry out the county's side of this, but I can certainly tie it to the city ordinance in which if you're going to be going through this process and registering your rental, you're going to attest in writing that you are complying with the state's homestead exemption laws. So it's just another step to create a way there to make sure that things are being done right. And it's a level playing field for everybody.
Do you have any way of knowing how much revenue you're losing out on because of this?
We don't yet. We're in the process of trying to come up with that, and we needed to check some things. What we're going to do is access different databases to do that, so we can look at the homesteads that are out there. That's public record. And then we can start to access things like the voter list. I think that's very telling. Some of those public sources of information, so when you see a homestead there and the voters registered in that house are not the same people, you know, that's a red flag. So we're starting to create a system of cross-referencing some of that. I hope within a few months we can start to come up with some numbers and tell us what that impact really is.
We've got about 10 minutes left today with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton here on Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Send questions for him or any of our other mayors to ask@WBAA.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. I wonder if you're ever in a position like Chris McBarnes is in Frankfurt. He comes on this program sometimes and tells us that he's not been able to contact the owner of a derelict rental property in the city, makes numerous attempts to contact this person, and then they eventually have to knock it down in some cases because it's in such bad shape. Do you have any properties like that?
We absolutely do. Yeah, that's part of this process is that, you know, many times these owners are just absent, and it's very hard to work in that situation. So this will give us one more tool in the toolkit to move through that process. But, you know, and during my time in office, we've taken down numerous houses, and we're moving through the process to probably take some more down. And many times these people, they know how to work the system. And so they're not going to, you know, you can send notices and do all these things. In the end, we're able to publish those and accomplish what we need to accomplish, but it just is drives up the expense and drives up the time involved.
Well, and violations, if I read this correctly, could cost people up to about $500. Is that right?
Per occurrence per day, I think. So it could add up quickly, and you know, that's part of the discussion we're having is how do we structure the fine structure. There's some language in there about the cost of an inspection. I expect that we will come back and tweak that some. We've tried to nail that down to what we think it is, but we're probably going to adjust it. The interesting thing is, you know, we had a city council meeting, and for us it was a pretty long meeting, but we heard a lot from landlords. It was interesting when you looked, virtually none of them, with a couple of exceptions, none of them lived in our community. You know, and they, you know, this is terrible, this is intrusion, and all these things. But I'm also hearing about 4-1 in favor of this from people in our community saying it's about time you're addressing this issue. It's about time we're trying to get control of our neighborhoods and stop letting these vacant landlords, you know, dictate what's happening. So it's a thorny issue. It's a tough issue, but I think we're moving in the right direction.
Well, what do you make of your critics who say, some of them, that this is government overreach?
Well, we certainly hear that. You know, I just counter that with the fact that I've spent 4 years listening to the people of this community, and they want this issue addressed. And I don't like more regulations than anybody. I don't like that at all. This takes our existing codes, doesn't apply really anything new, and just ties them together in one central source. So people are going to say that. It's interesting. We always hear, you know, that what about people's privacy if you're going to inspect these properties? Well, you know, there's 72 hours notice. You know, we have to have a reason to do some of these things. We're not going to just enter people's property. We're looking for the major issues. I don't care if their bed's made. That's not what we're after here. But we always hear that from landlords. We absolutely never hear it from the people who rent these properties. They speak up and say, yes, it's about time. We hear this from landlords, and as I always point out to them, they always have a provision in their lease that they can enter that property at any time. So, you know, are they really concerned about privacy? It doesn't appear that they are.
On to a couple other things in just our last few minutes. You met with Lieutenant Governor Eric Holcomb as he made a campaign stop not long ago in Crawfordsville. What did you say to him about his race, which some polls recently show him actually trailing?
Well, we didn't talk too much specifically about the race. You know, when I get a chance to talk with any of our elected officials at the state level or somebody who's running for office, I talk about what we're doing in our community, and I talk about some of the lessons that I think can be learned from small communities like ours. And so we spent some time talking about those things. And, you know, my biggest thing is you have to have good open dialogue and discussion. And I know he's in the heat of a battle right now, and that's tough. That is very tough. But I think it resonates. I think they understand that. I think when they hear it from local elected officials, you know, just remember, yeah, you're in this battle, but at the end of the day, we're all Hoosiers, and we all have to work together and you know, talk to people and find out what's going on and really stay in touch with reality. And that's the message that I try to impart as much as I can.
It's been really interesting for me on this program this election season to hear from you and Mayor McBarnes and Mayor Dennis, the three of the four of you who are Republicans on this program. And you and Mayor Dennis have at times been somewhat critical of Donald Trump. Mayor McBarnes says he supports Mr. Trump and has encouraged his constituents to vote for him. I wonder what effect, if any, you think that Donald Trump is having on particularly the down ballot races, the local races in Crawfordsville and in Montgomery County, if at all?
Well, I don't think he has any direct approach or direct effect other than increasing voter turnout. I think we're going to see the highest turnout that we've probably seen, I don't know, maybe ever, you know. So he certainly has that effect. Do people, you know, trickle down and say, well, because I support Donald Trump, I'm going to support candidate farther down the ballot? I don't know that that's the case. And I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I don't think that's as strong as it used to be. I think people today are savvy, they're educated, they have so much information at their fingertips. I'd like to think, anyway, they make decisions on each one of these offices on an independent basis rather than, well, I like the guy at the top, so I'm going to go to the person down ballot.
Well, that's interesting because Rex Early, who is the Trump-Pence campaign chairman for the state, was here in West Lafayette the other day, and his notion was kind of opposite of that. He said he thinks there are going to be more people who just pull the straight ticket Republican lever, and both Donald Trump and Eric Holcomb and Todd Young and all the down ballot Republicans are going to benefit from having Donald Trump at the top of the ticket. It seems like you're saying the opposite.
Yeah, well, I just don't see that in our community. I see people making their decisions on individual offices, but I guess, time will tell. But, my understanding with, especially in our case, the new voting equipment, the straight ticket thing is a little more complicated than it used to be. It's not just pulling the lever. So if you're going to do that, then it's going to come back and ask you a couple of questions, I think. Are you sure about these particular races down ballot? So, time will tell. I guess we'll see. We are in uncharted territory, that's for sure.
I got to ask, is Donald Trump getting your vote as a fellow Republican?
I've not made up my mind on this presidential thing. I'll be honest. I get asked that a lot. I struggle with this entire race, and I think I'm probably like a lot of Americans who just are shaking their heads, wondering how we ended up in this situation because we end up with two candidates who are not very popular. I like some of the things that Donald Trump says, but there are things that happen and things that he says that I just can't, I just have to shake my head. I just wonder where he's coming from on some of these things. So I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do when I walk into that ballot, into that voting booth yet. I'm very torn on all this.
But you think you're going to make your decision in the booth, it sounds like.
Well, probably before I go. It's probably one of those things that I'm going to have to come to terms with how I'm going to vote before I go. I don't think I'll make it right there on the spot, but I plan to vote early, but I may have to put it off. I don't know. They're just, in my mind, if you look at that, there's some scary scenarios both ways that I'm not comfortable with.
We also talked after the primary election about your desire to see the vote center model, which is fairly new to Montgomery County, change a little bit between the primary election in May and next month's general election. Have changes been made to your satisfaction in that time frame?
No. No, there were no changes made, and the explanation from the Election Commission was they didn't want to change and confuse people, between a primary and a general election, and I guess there's some merit to that argument, but I can tell you I will be pushing for change before the next time around because the situation as it exists right now is not acceptable for our community. To have one place to vote on Election Day in the city of Crawfordsville is wrong. That's just not enough. And they've centered those locations based on geography, not on population. And, there's a tendency to say, well, there are two others right on the periphery. But, those sites, you have to have a car to get there. They're not locations you can safely walk to or get to on a bicycle or anything like that. We saw very, very long lines in the primary at the one site in the city. So I think that we have to readdress that.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, that's the time we've got. Thanks for being on our inaugural program of Ask the Mayor on our 105.9 frequency, and we look forward to many more of them with you.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks. Same to you. This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember, you can find all of these programs archived at our website. That's WBAA.org. Just search for the Ask the Mayor page and tune in for our program next with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.